Welcome to the GamesNet Berlin Europe podcast. Here, we speak with extraordinary games industry professionals and listen to their story to learn all about what they've built and who they are. GamesNet Berlin Europe is the international games industry initiative of MediaNet Berlin Brandenburg, the networking association for the media, creative and digital industries in Germany's capital region. My name is Simon Oler, and I will be your host for this program. Today, we are speaking with Amir Mirzai, the managing director at BASE Esports. BASE is all about data in esports. If you think about it, esports is super data heavy compared to, for example, football. And by that, I mean soccer, of course, and I shouldn't even have to explain that. But back to topic, you can understand a football game if you know the score and maybe who scored, and then maybe the relevance of the score for the current league or competition. Now, think of League of Legends. At any given time, there are hundreds of data points, gold count, items, champion level, cooldowns, respawns, and much, much more, that you actually need to understand in order to know what's relevant in the game right now. And also think about the commentators. In esports, they're talking nonstop because they need to bring meaning to the game nonstop. Otherwise, we just lose track of what happens. So this is where BASE comes in. They help publishers make their data accessible. And Amir explains to us how he does it and how he sees the esports ecosystem. So we talk about this for quite a while in this episode. And then, of course, as always, beyond that, we get to know Amir personally. One of the most interesting topics we get to is that of the translator. These are the kind of people who grow up in between worlds and who are never really at home in one of them, but they can do a great job mediating and translating between them. Amir is one of them. I think I'm one of them, and we share our stories and experiences. So that's just a regular day at the office for the GMBE podcast. So we hope you enjoy our conversation with Amir Mirzai.
Hello and welcome to the GamesNet Berlin Europe podcast. Our guest today is Amir Mirzai, managing director at BASE Esports, a company in Berlin that works with esports data and analytics. He has Persian roots and was born in Iran, but grew up in Germany. His background is in tech and finance, and he's worked for Google, Icebear Capital, and an accelerator called the Plug and Play Tech Center, among others. Amir, how are you doing today?
Very well. Thanks for having me, guys.
Co-host, as always, is Simon. How are you?
Very well. A little fun fact. The house that I live in is being renovated by my very friendly landlords and landladies. And so for the first time living on the fourth floor, I have people walking past my window. Surreal experience. And as a guy who runs a podcast studio, more or less, dearly hoping for no to very little noise distractions from the outside. Other than that,
fingers crossed.
Other than that, doing fantastic. Thank you very much.
Fingers crossed. And I'm Florian, as always, co-hosting with Simon. So Amir, tell us a little bit about what's a topic that's on your mind at the moment, something that you are really into at the moment, something personally or for the company that you're focusing on.
Right now it's still such a crazy time. Like, it feels, I just had lunch with a friend and I talked about some thoughts that are kind of settling within myself and like in my surrounding that I see. So the one part that has more to do with me is that I try to shake off the pandemic day to day. Like, I'm seeing that, you know, I'm finding back to, let's say, a healthier mind physically, kind of day to day for myself. I'm going to the gym more regularly again and kind of getting a good rhythm back, because I feel like, you know, over the course of the last 2 years, you had a lot of kind of like an emergency feeling, and it was, everything was an exception and everything was kind of odd. But I feel like we're starting to get back into the day to day. And I kind of made a cut somewhere there and said, like, look, it also means that kind of have to get back into a healthier day to day for myself. And then I look around, and especially the political and the economic situation is just really strange. And I'm just trying to figure out what the implications are from, it seems to, everything seems to be more expensive at the supermarket, all the way down to, what's the revenue impact for Base down the line as we kind of go along, including the industry, like all these kind of things. Just, I feel like we're in a very, I keep having that question, whether it's like every time you're going through a different shift in times, it always feels like it's a crazy time. Like, let's say 30 years ago, was it also a crazy time when people thought like, oh, it's like things are changing, or is it just us that's really having like a weird time right now?
So have you talked
a little bit about the thoughts?
Have you talked to an older person recently who could have told you about?
I do ask these questions a lot, yeah. But then again, you know, you're like, it's because it was a very peaceful time, let's say, for a while. I'd say, you know, then the golden 90s and so on and so forth. But then I can't shake the feeling that we built a lot of systems and we built a lot of structure and infrastructure that was not sustainable to start with. Like I always say, you know, one plastic bag back in the day was a great idea, but a billion of them is not a good idea anymore, you know?
Definitely, no. Yeah.
It's just, I'm sorry, it's very deep talks, well, very deep thoughts right from the bat.
I asked you what's on your mind, so yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
So, since this is a new topic for us, what Base Esports does, I mentioned it's about data and esports analytics. Maybe let's start with you explaining to our audience what exactly you do there and why it's cool.
Just a quick note, I have a feeling we'll find the circle back to the deep stuff later on, pretty sure. Just mentioning because the topic changed now, but yeah, let's start with the work and then we'll get back to life, I'm pretty sure.
Awesome. Yeah, so at Base we structure, we monetize esports match data, or generally esports data, as you could say it. There's a whole industry of sports data as such, has very big players in it, like Sport Radar or Genius Sports, that have been at the market for 15-20 years. Both of the companies had their IPO. They focus around traditional sport. It's for me, even with my background that I had in terms of content licensing, I spent 6 years with Google doing license agreements in various ways, and then different capacities at other companies. This particular part of how sports data works was not so familiar to me. So in traditional sports, I always say you have a Champions League match, Bayern versus Chelsea, and any way that you want to connect to the sport, what's happening in the field right now, meaning the scores, the fouls, anything that there is, any digital application that wants to show that outside of, let's say, TV broadcast, for example, needs a data set to work with, right? So it's something that in our digital world is like this unseen magic where we're thinking there's some application, all of a sudden it knows what the score is within the match, but there's actually somebody that's licensing that data exclusively and then distributing it. Meaning if you go to Google and you type in, you know, Bayern Chelsea for that match, and you see the whole score and including the passes and all that kind of stuff, somebody collects that data, pays for it, then distributes that for various use cases, one of them being analytics and scoreboards and data visualizations and so on and so forth. But the other one, a very big part of that, is of course betting. So I'm not sure what your experience is. I remember 26, my world championship football that I watched. I kind of spoiled it because I had discovered bwin live betting, and I was always going about who has the next corner kick and so on. Mm-hmm. Lost, of course, all of my money, and also lost the joy in watching the matches, of course, because you were so focused around the next hap zone. But what's happening in that space, and this is really interesting in terms of a paradigm shift, is that in traditional sports, collecting data is very easy because it's very manual. There's like all these sports are made in a way that you see the field, you see everything, you see every player, you see the field, and you usually have a referee, let it be two or three referees in basketball or whatever it is, but you have a referee sport. There's somebody sitting there and he's saying it's a foul, it's a goal, it's a throw, and so on. And this happens so rarely, so to say, so every minute or every couple of minutes or whatever it is. You know, when we're watching football and you have three corner kicks in a row, you're already excited, right? Mm-hmm. But in esports, it's a completely different game. So in esports, you usually have 5-on-5, you have whatever it is, 3-on-3, or you have battle royale formats for like Fortnite and PUBG and so on. and then esports, so the professional sports leagues of a video game title, which is a huge industry these days that has grown very rapidly, collecting that data is very difficult. So it's very techy because you have over 100 different data points that change on a per second basis. Mm. And to keep up with that and to reflect that, to make it available to any kind of digital application, you need service providers like us. So we basically at Base, we came out of a joint venture with Sportradar, who's the largest in the traditional sports market, the industry leader on that side. And we built the esports ecosystem in terms of data by licensing data exclusively, let's say, for League of Legends, from Riot, from the ESL, for Dota and Counter-Strike, which are the top three game titles in the space. Mm-hmm. And within that, we kind of built this company that now is the industry leader globally for providing this data for the top leagues in esports to any kind of data consumer that needs it. So again, it's a lot of betting going on. Interestingly to say, betting has always been going on. It's a big industry. There's a lot of black market where it's forbidden. There's a lot of gray market where people bet from a location where they're not supposed to bet, mm-hmm. through an operator somewhere else. And then there's white markets. And because there's so much betting happening in the black and gray markets, we're trying very hard to move the betting part into the white space in particular. So meaning we're establishing official data offering, we're working with betting operators that are verified, that we know do legitimate business, and that where people can bet in a safe manner. And then the same way, of course, we distribute it to Google, who is a client of ours, and to other folks. So within that construct, I joined 2 years ago as the COO. I am also one of the two managing directors of the company. As we said, we have about 50 full-time employees here, plus 45 freelancers that are scattered around the world. And I oversee all commercial functions. So sales, legal, partnership, finance, as well as HR, actually. So we're two C-levels.
Nice. Wow.
I've got a few questions on top of my mind regarding the data, actually. So if we have, let's say, a League of Legends game, yeah? Mm-hmm. First question was, you're not getting any data from Riot, ? Do you have to have the like AI or tools or whatever? Like, how do you actually get the data? You have to collect it all yourselves?
Yeah, so I want to say that I didn't pay you for this question, but this is the golden question. Thank you for asking.
No
it
problem.
Because we're basically the ones that move. We're exactly the ones that don't do that. So we don't scrape. We don't go off of public feeds. We don't go off of collecting data, which was the case just 3-4 years ago before there were any official offerings.
So can you explain what it means to like scrape or whatever quickly?
Yes, absolutely. So it's another analogy. So if you're looking at the data market in esports, there is a lot of different game titles. There is a lot of different leagues actually out there. It's actually not like, let's say in Germany, you have one Bundesliga and then you have one Champions League and so on. It's very fragmented. Within that fragmented market, you had this new requirement, this new issue that collecting that data is so complicated. Now, because the game publishers from their side did not support yet accessing or making APIs available, like making any data interfaces available by which you could kind of officially pull that data and get a complete data set. Suppliers emerged that went on to Twitch or YouTube and started scraping, meaning running softwares that would analyze what's happening on the screen and from that try to extract, let's say, scores, gold counts, and so on and so forth. Now, the issue with that is that what I started off in the beginning with, esports is fundamentally different than sports, also in the way that you don't see the full play field. You're not supposed to see your opponent, right? It's not like in football where you know where the opponent is. In League of Legends, there's fog of war. You don't see the other half of the field. You don't know where those guys are. So if I get that from the stream, and I have any interruptions in that, then my data a set can only be incomplete, apart from not being sanctioned, right? So if a game publisher don't want you to bet on it, it's actually illegal to do so. This is you also just get a very poor data set. And if you have a poor data set, then you can imagine down the line you have poor products, right? So a Google cannot rely on that data, as well as a betting provider cannot really rely on that data, because who knows who did the next headshot, right? Who knows who did the next thing if you just had a blackout and you don't know which where basically the action took place as next. And so we came around and we were one of the providers that tackled it from our perspective. And this is just talking about ourselves now. We have a very strict policy that we only do licensed content. So we go to a riot and we said, right, we would love to license the content, but we need to have an API integration, meaning you need to make this available for us so that we can extract it in full quality and in completeness. And some other the sports work differently. So within the top three titles, that is League of Legends, which is Riot, Dota and Counter-Strike, which are Valve, in terms of game publisher. Valve, for example, does not open their APIs, but they sanction the offering and they make, let's say, access to files available so that we can pull and extract the data through our own technology in a different way.
So this is very, very detailed information, and it's amazingly interesting, at least to me, because... This is something that you don't really talk about that much. It's like if you're interested in esports and if you watch that stuff, you're constantly being confronted by data always. But it's like while you watch, it's like the air that you breathe. Basically, everything is a data point, and you get it constantly. That's right. But people don't really think about the game like that. So it's really interesting to look behind the curtain and see this from your side. So I hope if you think about it like that, that's to our audience, that's what makes this topic very interesting to talk about. And I think it's really cool to go very deep into this. One question that I personally would have, because I have experience in that area. I used to work for a company that ran its own ERL league in the Baltics for League of Legends. So you mentioned briefly the two publishers as examples, Riot Games and Valve. And it's interesting, as somebody who is a connecting factor like you are in data, that conversation with the publishers, to me, I mean, that's very niche interest, but to me, it's super interesting, these kind of negotiations of like, because esports hasn't been around as long as sports. So in sports, licensing and everything used to be there for quite a long time around this specifically. So can you go a little bit into like the conversations with the publishers? Like, were they, I mean, like you said, Valve really doesn't have that. They have a way around, but how do these kind of conversations go? Like, why do companies like, or the publishers say, oh yes, that's a good idea. We think somebody, a third party, should have access to that. To me, this is super interesting. It's super niche. I hope people don't like phase out immediately, but it's like, to me, these kind of things are like super behind the scenes and really interesting.
It's very correct. And it goes straight down to the reason why we exist and what the conversations are we have at the very core. And maybe tell me if I'm nerding out too hard and stop me in my tracks at some point.
Yeah, I would also say if you really talk about the conversations you're having now, it's always going to be interesting, because that's so interesting. So much business is like opaque and we want to know who talks to whom about what. So please go ahead.
Yeah, no, we're very much, I will map out the space to you guys. So... And this is basically it's largely, let's say, my job. Let's say partnerships is that, right? It's content. Like, where do we get that content from? And I think the basic difference, and we have to look at where esports coming from. Why does esports exist? Esports traditionally, if you look at the ESL is by the way, in this whole spectrum of, I have to keep addressing it, Berlin, Germany, as one of the esports hubs of the world, has a lot to do with a person called Jens Hilgers, whom you might want to have here on the show.
Shout out
as well. He's also from Berlin. Jens has been around for 20, 25 years. So we were just at IEM Cologne, which is Intel Extreme Masters, is one of the big Counter-Strike events globally, 14,000 people in the Lanxess Arena, right? So you have to go and just experience it. For us, it was great. We took the whole team. And we also have kind of, as we grow as a company, of course, not just esports nerds there, but also kind of a lot of folks that don't have anything to do with esports. And I can just recommend for everybody and anybody, like you go to a football stadium, spot some of these really big esports events and go and see what the excitement is so you understand the sport. And so he talks a lot. So he founded a few companies that now are kind of the very base of the esports scene here. One of them is G2 as the team. That we have in Berlin that wins world championships. The other one is basically after Bayern of esports here. Big is another one, another Berlin team. They will probably hate me for saying that, but those are the two big teams. One of them founded by Jens Hilgers, and then Jens actually also founded our company back in the day. Then moved on to establish Bitcraft as the largest esports venture fund. Esports crypto venture fund in the world, probably the largest with that sole focused globally, based here in Berlin actually, and then also founded the ESL. And the ESL has been around for I think 20 years. So you might have just seen that it just got acquired by a Saudi conglomerate for over $1 billion.
Yes.
And within that scope, you have to understand why certain companies exist. So the difference, and it has just grown, you know, as with the ESL over the last 20 years and has accelerated over the last 10 years. Back in the day, we all probably remember it to some extent, people would meet for LAN parties, right? They would meet for network parties, they would bring their computer, and then they would play together. Or somewhere over the last 20 years, I used to do that as a student.
Guilty as charged.
Back in the day, CSGO, still Counter-Strike, back in the day was the title, right, that people were playing a lot. Then at some point, World of Warcraft, out of World of Warcraft came Dota, out of that came League of Legends, and so on and so forth. But at some point, you had competition. People were like, the LAN party, the parties got bigger, and people were like, okay, who's the best? And in the beginning, they were playing for a box of beer.
Yep.
And it was more about bragging rights. And then teams got better. They got more consistent. Then fandom created, got created, kind of established itself, right? The teams, they kind of came together, not just for the parties, but they actually started training. Then sponsorships came. Then events started coming. Then people would start paying admission for it. And so on and so forth. Fast forward, we're in the Lanxess Arena, 14,000 people sitting there. You have massive teams of professionals that earn a couple of million, some of them, a year. And with a prize pool of $1 million just for that particular tournament that you have there. So the winner takes 400K home and so on and so forth. You look at Dota, one of the other three games. They have their event, one of their top events in Singapore later in October. Prize pool of about 40 million, I think, 40. And this is how it all kind of got established. Now, within this, everything that has been created, esports is basically the professional league of a video game title.
Thank you.
Right. So basically,
thank you for keeping it real.
Yeah. So this is the definition, right? It's the professional sports of a game title.
Yes.
Right. So it's that segment. And why do you have it? It is, in the end of the day, it has been created. Look at Counter-Strike. It's been around for 20 years. It creates longevity, sustainability for this title. Nobody from my office, none of the, let's say, non-gamers from my office would have gotten in touch with Counter-Strike ever again. Mm-hmm. As the summit. It's just an old title. It's like an old movie, so to say. But it keeps coming back because it's an esport now. It's in the middle of athletic performance, and it has this whole fandom created around it.
And that's culture, by the way, right? That this coming back,
right.
That is culture, that is shared language,
absolutely.
Shared experience. That's, right. That's why I can quote Pulp Fiction to a dude I'm meeting at a party, and we're having a laugh, and we're friends now. And that's shared culture. That's
100%. That's what I keep saying. I cannot say it enough. Anybody that hasn't been, go to any of the big events and look at how fanatic the people are. Like I walked up, like the comments that I got, I walked up with some of my colleagues. The colleagues were like, oh, these guys have like, they got like jerseys on. I'm like, yeah, of course they got jerseys. It's a team. And then it was like a big line outside. It said signing. I was like, what are they signing? It's like, yeah, they're giving autographs. It's like, oh, like a football. He's like, yes, it's a sport.
Imagine.
It's an ecosystem,
it's
right?
Part of their lives. Like, this is, they care about this. Brings meaning into their lives. And, yeah, yeah.
And it's and the under 30 and 25 year olds is the only thing they care about these days.
Yes. So and you have to just to interject here about this culture thing, and like it is in this way exactly because we also have this conversation always about how is it like sports, yada yada yada. Maybe we can get to that or not. But what you have is you have these like moments that are ingrained in a community, like moments that happened in a game that was played 10 years ago. Faker Z versus Ryu in that KT Epic. Versus SKT Korean match. Yeah. And people to this day will look at that clip as a review, like when, for example, German fans watch the goal by Lars Ricken or something from 97. So exactly. It's like this, moments like this are just in the culture.
Please keep that. Yes. Keep that thought. I will come back to it later. Please keep that thought and come back to that later. But so in this whole story, now we have a huge sport, 600 million people worldwide that watch this kind of stuff, 100 million for League of Legends and so on. And within that, you have a different setup than in traditional sport, because in traditional sport, the rights for that sport, there is nobody owning football rights, like football as a sport. But it's different for a video game. So the video game, the game publisher, it's the game publisher's view that we need to understand. So they have a title. That title has different revenue streams, right? Back in the day, it was selling copies. Then it started being digital goods. Now it's still digital goods. If you look at Riot, they do $1.5 billion selling nothing but skins. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so skins for the players and so on and so forth, which again is a different kind of revenue stream. Then you have broadcast. Then you have sponsorships in esports. And so on and so forth as you kind of go along. And so these guys understand they need to do esports. Riot actually was the only one that has always been esports first, but all the other game publishers that's been around forever, for them, this whole esports thing is really hard to handle because you need a whole league structure. How does my league work? How do I want this to be? Like in, let's say, for example, Riot. Riot is always the hallmark example because they are esports first. They do it all themselves. And maybe this is also one of the examples that you said before. It's also some of the frustrations that some of the independent organizers, so to say, had back in the day. Because at some point, they said, we need to streamline everything we've built across the globe. We'll all do it ourselves now. Meaning you have one pillar that is league operations, tournament operations. The other one that's the infrastructure platform that sits beneath it, like the server infrastructure and the models that it plays by and so on. So there's a whole technical infrastructure. And the third pillar is how do we extract that data that comes from this and distribute it across the globe? And now, if you look at a Riot, they do the league structure themselves. So the first pillar, they do the digital infrastructure, the technical infrastructure themselves. But for the third pillar, they got us. So we're the ones that actually built the data models. We're the ones that have our own distribution. We have our teams and our sales teams and the whole commercial model, and we go out and sell this. This is just an extra overhead that they don't want to do redundantly, because for us, this is economies of scale. We hire this team once, we build a portfolio of content, and they can sell all of it instead of the 50 people that we have for each of these guys to do and build this themselves, plus for each of them to have a different API than that clients have to attach to.
Okay, so here is the point, I think, where the original question comes back in, and it's, okay, who talks to who about what? And I think you explained it like generally, but I'm really curious about that, how that conversation goes.
So this one was the, let's say, this was the most straightforward case. Yeah, so there's a game publisher, he does it mostly themselves, except for data distribution, that's what we do. Now, if you look at a Valve, they don't want to do any of it themselves. So they need a third party for the league operations. That's somebody like the ESL. That's their job. They go and they say, this is how the league works. And they execute it. Right? Yep. For example, Counter-Strike, that's what they do. Then the company next to it is Faceit. That's the digital platform. Those two companies just merged and they got acquired by the Savvy Group for over $1 billion. Now we're the third part in that infrastructure that distributes that data. Now, for these three pillars, there's, of course, different companies. ESL is not the only operator that there is. So there's the ESL, for example. There's PGL. There's BTS and so on. So like a lot of operators in that field. For the middle part, there's different service providers that play. And all of these guys, now different combinations, go to game publishers, go mainly to, let's say, an Activision Blizzard and say, Call of Duty is on a great roll. It's very US specific. Let us do one of these pillars either individually, or we kind of join forces and we tackle them together and say, this is where it goes out of the box. Here you go. Dear Ubisoft, for Rainbow Six, you don't have to do any of this themselves. You don't have to do any of this yourself because we can do it for you. Now, the conversation that we're having, of course, on the backside is ESL, that is already our partner. Now they're merged with Faceit. For us as Space, of course, very attractive to look for a solution where we have like a whole out of the box, any game publisher, like let's say a Ubisoft for Rainbow Six could go and say, I have you guys as a team, and the whole topic of esports is kind of covered in itself, because none of these, the big ones and the big ones that are relevant now in esports are, at least in the Western Hemisphere, China and Asia have a bunch of game titles that are not too relevant for over here, but they have massive following over there. But if you look at Ubisoft, Rainbow Six, you look at Krafton for PUBG in particular for mobile in particular, again, relevant for India as a mobile-only market. You look at Activision Blizzard, who were not too successful with Overwatch in terms of their esports, had to dial it all back. Went, you know, from going online and doing big league operations back to doing offline events. Online events only. And then you have, Activision Blizzard? Mm-hmm. Those guys, Krafton, Ubisoft, are the big ones. You have, of course, the very obvious ones that are just very difficult. Let's say EA Sports has a...
Quick interjection again. I'm sorry. I just want to nail the point a little bit, because I still don't understand exactly what conversation are we having. Maybe let's keep it to the two. Let's keep it to Riot and let's keep it to Valve. So to get the data and so on. To Riot, you say, hey... please give us an API or something to get the the data, and to Valve you say the same. This was the golden question, right? This is you're actually getting data straight from the publisher, not through looking at the picture or something, right?
Very short answer. Yes. So the very short answer is we talk to Riot, we license the content exclusively, we need an API to work for it. We go with that same a concept to a Ubisoft that don't have that yet, to the same concept to an Activision Blizzard who don't have that yet, and we pitch them on it and say, look, guys, you need to do this. The ecosystem needs your data. You need to make it available.
And that's where the scale comes in. That's where you're saying, hey, we are the people who've done this before. We can just guide you through this. Just give us this. And then,
That's correct.
And then what? You license this data by another API that you give to, let's say, betting sites, Google. So I assume if I Google like whatever G2 versus T1 or whatever, whatever shows up at the top of Google, that's probably your data, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason why I kind of explained it so expansively is to kind of make it look confusing, because it is very confusing and it is a very fragmented market. So if you look at a business model, I think this is where this is interesting, right? Let's look at Stripe as a company in terms of payments. What did Stripe do? They took all of these different payment providers and they standardized the way you can access them, meaning you as an e-commerce provider, you have one API, and that API gives you all the payment options. This is what we want to be for esports. So meaning anybody that had to connect to all these different APIs and all these different data models before, at some point we want to be that one interface that you have to connect to, and everything else is sorted for you.
Yeah, and then of course you have a lot of you kind of also decide what data is important, right? This is where you also gain a lot of influence, I guess.
Yeah, I think, you know, and this is the interesting piece. What's really, I mean, where we are really a tech startup is that the data models that we've developed is not as straightforward. It's not that simple, because you have different game titles, you have different mechanics, how they work. We're the ones that standardize and normalize a lot of these, and then we've built our own data distribution infrastructure. I posted a data point the other day. I mean, we're distributing over 300 million data points on a regular weekend. It's just a lot that we kind of go through crunching. And within that, though, you have all these different use cases for whom different titles are attractive. Let's say betting, for example, cares mainly about those three titles that we currently offer. A Google, for example, cares about more. They want the PUBG results as well. They want the Rainbow Six leagues as well, even though there's not a lot of betting going on.
They just want to serve the general Google customer, right?
Correct. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, exactly. Mm.
And so I guess last question in my line of inquisition here. How do you specifically, and also you as a person, you as base as well, what do you value? What's important to you when you kind of decide on which data do we distribute and which we don't? Which data we want to make the most kind of like palatable and which we don't care so much about? Because that actually will, with your goal of being this one-stop shop, influence the landscape greatly. And maybe people care about this, you know, what you actually, you know, which, yeah, you're telling the story at the end of the day, in a way.
Right. So we're out there. So there's two sides to this. What we need to do as base, as a startup, of course, as a young company driving for profitability, we need to go by the top revenue use cases. So betting data is by far the largest revenue stream. Globally, it's a huge industry. Sports betting itself is probably over $1 trillion in volume. We say esports is somewhere between 2 to 10 billion, which is also a big market. So we have to go for our own kind of, let's say, the low hanging fruit, the top priority for the top three titles that get mostly bet on. We need to aggregate as much of the, let's say, top leagues and all of the mid tiers to make them available as a button and say, this is kind of first we cater to the betting side. Then as we go along and as we start talking about the ecosystem, we do want to get all of those titles on that have most traction in terms of viewership. So where are we serving the biggest ecosystem? Who has the most players in terms of regular gaming, but also who has the most viewership in terms of hours watched and so on. So a couple of KPI to go by. And then you end up with a list of probably 10 game publishers that you wanna get the games for. Now, within that, and even though we do want that, it's interestingly difficult to get the game publishers to understand that this is what's absolutely necessary to connect to their ecosystem. Because as I said, you know, the bizarre thing is that if you want to provide any kind of context for a live match that is running, in terms of the data that you serve to any digital application, and be that a companion app or a scoreboard somewhere, if there's nobody that really extracts the data and structure, you cannot serve your community. Mm-hmm. And even that thought is not as trivial to place as you would think, because these guys are also not, this is very interesting, the data extraction, the export that we're asking for, the cars are not made for it. Interestingly, I think it's a little bit like, and I always compare us because we're in a little bit of a Daimler versus Tesla, like traditional car makers versus a very modern one that has a built-in system that in itself is more of a platform. It's more of an app store that is supposed to connect to external developers and so on and make applications available, right? I mean, this is the big Tesla case. Tesla has a market cap that's 10x of Daimler. Why is that? It's because their data infrastructure is more flexible. It's a platform, while Daimler is a car, and that data is not supposed to leave that car. Mm-hmm. And it's the same for game titles. Traditional game titles are not supposed to give the data out.
Yes.
And so they have to build that for us to serve their own ecosystem. And now, It's I want to say, concerning how long it takes for these guys often to get around to doing that. Riot is the only game publisher that does it. The only one.
So this to me, and this will be a complete topic switch, but because I have an analogy for it, and I want to see your opinion on it. Because it's a very different approach to it, but a very similar kind of talk, I assume. So currently, and over the last years in games now, we have this whole crypto debate. and like how NFTs are implemented in games. And so we have this exact same problem that publishers of games own the IP. And in the market right now, there are always these discussions like, what do third-party NFT sites or marketplaces or whatever offer to the publishers that they couldn't do themselves in their own ecosystem? Why would it be interesting to open it up to give something out that you actually like own? Would you be interested in that? Because obviously, let's say, why would EA share data that then could be used? And that's the more specific thing here, that could then be used in Ubisoft's games. So just from your, let's compare NFT, and that's what they basically are. They are data in a way. Let's compare NFTs here to esports data. Just if you can like relate to this topic in any way, what's your opinion on this? Do you think, like, are NFTs the same in an abstract way? And also, do you think, where do you think we're going with this topic?
I think the underlying common theme here is who is in control.
Yes.
And you know, it's in the end of the day, that's why I built this whole game publisher at the center of the whole ecosystem. It's a game publisher's work.
Yes.
Right. And so they built their game titles, and it's a lot of work, and they're huge companies and they have massive costs, and I get it. It's not at the core of the business, and now NFTs come around. And now online betting comes around, which is also a tricky topic. Both of them are tricky topics, right? Because betting happens, right? And also crypto happens, but you don't know yet how to control it. And so for a lot of these companies that a day before yesterday were still selling CD copies, all of a sudden the world is very difficult to understand and to control. And so they're treading very carefully in terms of opening up, and kind of, they're not used to surrendering control at all, zero. And I think they also shouldn't. I think it's part of the problem. But they're also kind of a little slowish in terms of moving around. It's just very big companies that come with different, and this is the thing. A lot of things that seem so obvious to you and me just take a while, because, you know, this may be the reputation of the game publishers at stake. Some of them are still family owned companies, by the way. And then, you know, and then the IP itself is at stake, and so on. So it's a complicated, like, slow grinding matter, which again, for our startups, the cycles take, I don't know, 2 years, 3 years till we get to a point where everybody's comfortable. And actually, in that whole context, you know, that's why we, for example, started talking less about betting, even though betting is already taking place. Yeah. In places that you don't want it to take place, right? For instance, say, for example, also Valve's kind of skin betting issue that they had and so on was because they didn't tackle it properly until they tackled it, until it became an issue, until it kind of popped up. But we have to be very upfront with it that there is a lot going on. And if you're not controlling and actively participating, then it's happening in a way that people might come to harm. It's happening in an unregulated way. It's happening in a way where people might lose their money or whatever it is. So it opens the door for scammers. So I think this is probably the paradigm. Yeah.
All right. Let's maybe jump a little bit to you personally, because this was very in depth, and I think we drove this point quite far, but I think it's okay to move on. So Amir, personally, like, you mentioned briefly that you were always like a gamer, as you say, but you told us in our talks coming up to this that you lost track of games at some point, and as we mentioned, you worked at Google and other places, so it wasn't so obvious that you would end up in games and esports. How did that come about?
Yeah, so I mean the longer story, starting at Adam and Eve. So I was born in Iran, as you said, and there was 84. We fled back in the day, the Khomeini regime, back in place. My father, a translator and journalist, and my mom, a a teacher, both jobs, you know, very tricky in terms of being outspoken, open-minded, and so on. So we kind of had to leave the country, grew up here. I got my first Nintendo back when I was age 5, and I was a complete gaming fiend for a very long time, like every good immigrant kid. It was kind of my babysitter with my mom that was kind of raising me single-handedly. And that was kind of my big passion. Luckily, I had two passions. One was football. I was actually out playing football, but when I was home, I was playing video games. I was definitely one of those kids that I couldn't do stuff with Legos or Playmobil and so on and so forth. There was too little happening for me to kind of enjoy. Maybe I was already spoiled by then in a negative way, as we would say today. I think today I would look at it and I can still see how playing video games has had an impact on problem solving and so on for me. I'm very sure of it. And so as I kind of grew along, you know, you get into teenage years, you continue playing, get into university, studied business back in Hamburg, which left a lot of time for other stuff. And that other stuff in my case was getting into startups and entrepreneurships and going to startup conferences and so on. And during that time, kind of my gaming slowed down a bit. I now know that this part was exactly the period where, you know, Warcraft 3 turned into World of Warcraft and World of Warcraft turned into League of Legends and so on. So all of these massive multiplayer games kind of came on that just ate days at a time for you to play, which is a good thing. When that, this was the time when I started more being into kind of like startups and building businesses and so on. So almost want to say I dodged a bit of the bullet, but I was always an avid gamer and a player. You know, if I go and look at what I play now, it's more single player stuff. It's like Ghost of Tsushima on my PS5 or God of War or like a Horizon. Like I love these really deeply story immersive games that you have. For me, it's almost, I don't want to say it's almost, for me, it's a lot more gratifying actually than, and I love movies, but to watch a movie, because like it's a good movie is like 2 hours, 3 hours, and it can take you, but a video game, if it catches you for 30, 60 hours, 100 hours on end, it's just absolutely astounding. I think the last experience that I had is particularly with God of War or Horizon. It's like all of a sudden you're in this incredibly immersive world where like every stone is lying there for a reason. Mm-hmm. Somebody painted that there. Somebody put it there. Somebody did that.
And in
there.
Both of so, these cases, the gameplay really slaps. I really enjoyed God of War because it's Jesus so slappy Christ. And just so,
wow,
so eruptive and so much impact. Totally. And you hit somebody with this damn shield, you know, and it's like, bang, you know, exactly. In your face.
Exactly, exactly. And this, it has become such a polished experience in terms of haptics, right? Yeah. Your controller shakes. In terms of sound, right? It has to make the right size. I almost still, to this day, I think people play Candy Crush for the sound and not for anything else. Like this like cha-ching, you
that's
know,
nice, kind of goes. Nice. Hey, actually, let me ask you something about this whole, your whole intro when it comes to like gaming as a babysitter. Yeah. Gaming as a thing that's, you know, just more interesting than other things. I've got some theories on this, and because I know you have a long story, so I'll just jump in and then we can just take the detour a bit. Mm-hmm. Thinking a lot about the purpose of gaming myself, intending to make a movie about it, about how games, you know, actually help us and what meaning they have in our lives. And also thinking a lot about like varieties of, and I want to be careful here, like neuroatypical things. And I've been explaining it recently that, you know, for me it was the same, obviously gaming just the only thing that engaged my brain enough, it feels like.
I
still have it today. Like, I mean, I can't, like, you know, Hoover my flat or something without listening to a podcast. It's like physically impossible, right? Because it's just not engaged enough. Is this something that you've thought about or that you felt like is relevant? Yeah, this kind of full blast that games deliver with sound, cognitive, this whole stress they put you under, the good one. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I realized that. It's something that I had thought about a lot as well. It's a hyper stimulant.
Yeah,
let's put it this way. Other things are hyperstimulants as well, from sugar to television to whatever it may be. But we have to say it's a stimulant that you have to be aware of, that you have to dose, right? If you have a kid that's playing nonstop, like I was playing back in the day, and then, you know, kind of has issues sleeping and so on and so forth, and can't focus at school, then there's maybe a little too much, and you need to intervene at some point, right? I do believe there is that element to it. I don't think in itself.
Sometimes I wonder if it's the other way around. By the way, the kid
possibly,
you know, can't focus at school because it's just how it is, and school is just not possibly engaging enough. It's not the right product.
Absolutely. this was us, yeah, too. We I think we talked about this before. For me, definitely. This definitely the two things that kind of collide. Like, you know, I have friends that eat a piece of chocolate and they let it be, you know. I'm not that guy. But I also was not that guy to kind of, you know, I have friends that you would play video games with after an hour, they were like, I'm tired of it. And I was not that kid. But then at the same time, I see in other stretches of life that, you know, my desire to push forward, my curiosity, my drive and all of that, it feels like it feeds from the same pool, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think it's like, one is like, you know, how prone are you to something? The other one is what it is in terms of how susceptible you are to it as well. But I think at the very core, at the very base, and I don't want there to be any misunderstanding, video games are something very, very positive. Mm. I think it's an art form. It's a way to interact. It's a connector between cultures, people in the world, like individuals, anything, like anything good and positive that you can think of it, that's what it is. And anything that comes around it, like with sugar, alcohol, or whatever it is, there can be abuse. That's not the problem of the medium itself. It's just abuse. That's it. Okay. So, I think, you know, part of what it might have done, I'm with you on that. I don't know whether I always needed a brain that needed more stimulation. And this is why I couldn't play Lego, because there's not enough happening for me. Maybe I'm autistic to some extent. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But the other piece is just as true as well. It is a very strong stimulant that might change the way that your brain works and so on and so forth. So I would be very interested to understand more. I think it's a great topic to explore.
Yeah, we're looking more into it. And then and then I also, like you said, it feeds from the same source. If you say you kind of replace the gaming with more company building, I mean, company building totally is a high stimulant too, which shouldn't be abused.
Yes, absolutely. It's 100% right. It's exactly like, why is it that I go from the one extreme to the other extreme? Yeah. And actually, just now it was my introduction. I right now I feel like I have a very good balance at age 39. Nice. Like, where I'm like, okay, I don't do meetings on Fridays. I go to the gym 3 times a week. I don't watch TV in the evening anymore. That I learned about me, that I shouldn't watch TV during the week in the evening, because I would sleep better and I'll spend my time doing other stuff. And then I have more energy to do the things that I like. So I would say in the past it was, you know, fueled by a lot of, let's say, gaming access and excess and so on, which kind of grew my fondness. And then after, you know, kind of after the startup time that I had, which was very tough, you know, like a year and a half doing my 100 hours a week just to crash the, or let's say, fire sell the company in the end of the day, then going into consulting and doing the same gig. It was my first 3-4 years, and then you know, seeing that I didn't want to do consulting because I get too excited about things and I want to stay involved. I kind of got, I don't want to say lucky, but I was in the right place in the right time for Google, kind of to switch jobs. And my old co-founder had a contact at Google, which back in the day, it was 2007, 2008, which wasn't so common back then, right? I feel like nowadays everybody knows somebody and so on. Back in the day, it was like a little more rare, and it was, you know, like you said, dude, what are these conversations like with the game publishers? Because there is not so many. It's like, I had zero idea what life inside of Google would look like. So you were still at the point where you think everybody's a robot that works at Google, and it's like a big mystery box. So I saw a job posting, strategic partnerships. I didn't know what it means. it sounded great. So I applied for it through that friend, and it just so happened that, you know, I kind of was a good fit in terms of having done strategy consulting, which is having strategic discussions with higher level ups, and then having like a very entrepreneurial spirit, you know, being a good contract negotiator and so on. So that set me on that path. Then at the very end of that, you know, comes 2020. Let's say very fast forward, 2020, I sit at home and, you know, I just like, I came out of the family office. I was switching jobs that fell through because the pandemic had hit right then in mid-March, and was going to do the CEO job for another company, and their follow-on funding fell through and so on. So a cascade of things that actually had me, let's say, grounded for the beginning of the pandemic. And I had this big stack of amazing games sitting there that I had neglected for years. Diablo 3, Horizon, God of War actually sat there for a year before I played it, and so on. And I ended up playing 2 months straight. And then at the end of that, I was like, I was so passionate, because coming back to how polished these experiences are by now, this is what a beautiful topic this is. I've always wanted to work in this. I've never understood how the industry works itself, but I always wanted to have a part in gaming. And so coming back now to Bitcraft, and Jens Hilgers, his co-founder at the fund, is Malte Bart, who was my old boss at the consulting firm over 10 years ago, turned into a very good friend, is a great guy. And I said, Malte, what's up? we always wanted to find a job for me, right? And he was like, yeah, of course, here. We have this company. It's content licensing. It's data. It's esports. And they're looking for a COO. And yeah, 2 months later, I had the job.
How did you meet Malte? Sorry, two questions at the same time. I was just curious how you met Malte.
So he was one of the partners at the consulting firm Skillnet, so a smaller boutique, but very exciting topics in Times Market, so media convergence, online businesses. And he was one of the partners there.
Right.
Also, let's say, sadly, one of the first examples that I had in my kind of very high-paced environment of people that kind of had health issues very early on because we worked too hard. And one of the factors that then also influenced me to not kill myself for the job, you know, as I went on, which is not that easy when you go to the US and everybody thinks it's awesome to say they've been running a half marathon at 5 a.m. and stay until 10 o'clock. So kind of set me on the right path there.
Nice. And Malte, for context, is also kind of the second man at Bitcraft, which is the
right.
Segas fund. So for those who want to look some people up. Yeah. And Florian, sorry, what were you saying?
I was just saying that, so among others, like something that we always point to when talking to our guests, because usually we ask them how they ended up in the industry and like how their experience was, and ways are always different. But stuff that comes back is that among skills that you developed in very different industries, another thing that's very important and that should always be mentioned is you kept connections, basically, because this is still something that is very prevalent in games and esports, that it's a very connection-based industry. So just for the audience out there, if we always have people in the audience who want to work in this or be in games and esports. So if you have the ability to network with people, that's a very important skill as well.
My life changed back in the day when I was 24. I was doing my business studies. We had like a small online business among me and my friends. It's like entrepreneurship and startup stuff. And we decided to go to Idea Lab at WAU back in the day. And it was the first time that I actually immersed into an ecosystem, because before that, you're isolated in what you're doing. And once you do that, everything changes. You meet people, you give people the chance to actually meet you before you apply. You find out a lot more about what you're good at, what your interests are. You get so many more different impulses. I think that set my life on a very different path. After that, I said, even if I don't know what I'm getting out of it, I'll go to an event, rather than not. And I would say it's probably the most important thing in terms of career advice.
We have a lot of people talking about this kind of seemingly inherent goodness, which is dangerous to say, of course, but of the people in the video game industry that and I mean my first job out of uni was at Twitch, so I never knew anything else, and it was like, yeah, I mean, sure, that's it, right? But I guess I'm really spoiled, and some people come into that industry and are like, oh my god, they're like some genuinely like cool and nice and chill and sweet people here.
Yeah, totally. I was done with the tech industry after Google and so on and so forth, and it's nice, it's great and whatever. But I found it was not my people. And then I realized gamers are my people. So I second what you're saying. Gamers are a different kind of nerd. I always say they're the more social nerds, you know, because it's a together, it's a joint kind of doing things. And while everybody's a nerd, including myself, it's just a together. It's just like a more social kind of doing things. It's very different.
And speaking of your career changes, I think you said something earlier, you know, when we spoke the last time, actually, that you had like this. Yeah, I guess I want to ask you a bit about your energy or your drive, because, you know, also in this conversation, you know, I can see you're like super driven. You can talk for a very long time. You know, we ask a question, you roll the story up at the beginning. I know these behaviors from myself.
Yeah.
And then, yes. And I think you said that you were always like kind of like not so oriented. So you had to orient yourself by your own values.
Yeah.
And so you had a lot of drive. You were always kind of a smart ass / trailblazer.
Right.
And you also, you kind of ran your various careers as far as you could, but then until you couldn't anymore.
Yeah.
What's the story here?
Yes. Yeah, actually, while you're talking about it, I realize one more thing, and I make that connection about why I was so unpopular as a student.
Let's hear it.
But it's, I mean, why do we do these things? Why do we do these things? Because I want to understand. I'm interested. It's a good, it's at the core a positive thing, right? I'm genuinely naturally curious.
Curious cat.
I want to understand everything. I'm super curious. Like there's nothing. I realized at some point there's nothing that cannot be fascinating in itself.
Yeah.
Nothing. Explain anything to me, and there's some level of fascination in there somewhere if I dig deep enough to understand why things are the way that they are. And my problem was growing up as a kid. And also it's a curious kind of combination, maybe, because, you know, my mom, academics and so on and so forth. But then again, as immigrants here, it was always don't cause trouble, you know, don't ask why, don't, you know, kind of fall out of line and so on and so forth. But I wanted to understand, you know, I grew up in a world that looked like it is set the way that it is. This was like growing up. This is what frustrated me. And the more you ask why as a kid, the more unpopular you get. It's like, don't ask so many questions. You know, this was it. It's like, why? Don't bullshit me. Tell me why. You know, why is it like that? And why do I have to be here? Why have to I say this? And why do I have to wear that? That was always in me. I still remember my mom said it at some point. She said, I always had a very thick head. And she said, I came home once as an immigrant kid. My mom was just learning German. I, of course, already in kindergarten. I learned it, and I said, from one day to another, I don't want to talk Farsi anymore. I want to speak German. And she said, okay. And then she couldn't sway me. It was like, this was me. But then the next week, I was like, I only want to speak Farsi. Whatever it was. I was super funny. I have this one very good friend of mine, age 3, we met in kindergarten. And he was like his German family, and it was, you know, his parents call me their third son. I grew up with him, and he said, I came, we're not from a religious household, but said at some point I came at age, I don't know, 5 or 6 or whatever, would always have breakfast when we had sleepovers. And I said, I don't want to eat pork anymore. out of nowhere. And he said, okay, cool, no problem. And then she wouldn't buy Leberwurst anymore. And the next week I was sleeping. I was like, where's my Leberwurst?
We'll said, only eat this now.
She said, and he said, I thought you don't want to eat pork anymore. I said, well, if it's Leberwurst, then I guess I do. So that was the back and forth. And so within this whole thing, I didn't know where to put my curiosity and to put my skills. So I turned into a troublemaker. That turned into my identity, to be that rebel. And then, you know, if often enough you kind of get told that the way you are is not okay, you kind of start rejecting that too. And it builds this stream, like it builds this spiral, you know, that I can 1,000,000% understand that, you know, young people and especially immigrants are on, because if you get rejected so often, then at some point that frustration sits so deep and it turns into anger. And then at some point you say, I just, sorry, fuck it, but it's like, I'll do it my way and whatever it is. And I was on that path where I always had to make sure that, you know, I do hit my grades, where I do hit my, you know, kind of get, where I do get admitted to tests and so on and so forth. Like math in school, I would have either gotten a fail or an A grade, right? Mm-hmm. There was nothing in between, because either I wouldn't show up or I would hit it out of the park, right? And part of that was the rebellion, saying, you know, I don't need to do this and yada yada. But I also had a very rough time finding inspiration in people. Right, things, people that I would really, that really stood for what they're doing, that had that interest, and my savior was probably my sports teacher, back in school, then 11th grade or so, and he was amazing. He was a German literature teacher, and then at the same time a sports teacher, and he would, you know, tell us all about Goethe, and then at the same time, and then in the next hour, he would beat us 1-6 and people like in volleyball, right? That kind of stuff. And it was like amazing. This is what I want to be.
Was he still quoting Goethe while he was playing volleyball?
Exactly. So, you know, this was kind of starting to find role models. And that then, though, didn't have anything to do with business and economy, and was my friends then when I first started, you know, started dabbling into
entrepreneurship. Hey, let me back you up real quick. What was it about your sports teacher that you saw? I want to talk more about this guy, because I'm so curious about when kids like you and me and Florian probably like kind of like own, these free spirits or something. It's hard for us to find people we relate to. Why this guy? What was it about him?
Because he was good at something that I wanted to be good at. Like, he was good at sports, you know? He was well spoken, but he also had he looked a little bit, maybe now when I think about it, like He-Man. Like, he had long hair. He was in good shape, of course. I mean, not the tallest, but he was in good shape. You know, I wanted to be in good shape. Like, I was a chubby kid. I wanted to be in good shape. And he was outspoken. He had a very nice manner being with people. And he was just really good at sport. And I wanted to be good at sport. And I wanted to be that. And so he caught me with something that I want to be good at. Mm. And I think this is the same pattern, right? You have to find something that you want to be good at, and then find people that are good at that. The way that he reached us was very...
Yeah, exactly. I was going to ask, did he pay any special attention to you or to everybody?
Yeah, exactly. This is very true, yeah. And then he built me up. Then he saw
what
that.
Did he do?
He saw
what,
that I was.
What happened? Like, yeah.
He would. So he had this thing. He would throw his whole bundle of keys at people in the classroom. So he would always call me out and throw his whole bundle of keys at me and call me out for chatting too much and being a lazy bum and so on and so forth. But then in the next hour at sports, he would come to me and say, you know, you're one of my most important people here. You know, you're one of my in volleyball, you know, you're the central position. Like, he built me up in terms of, like, I don't want to say I'm that, but Mike Tyson's autobiography is just so fascinating, because he's the ultimate part, like, he's the ultimate example of such a story. And he says what Gus D'Amato did was he broke him down and he built him back up. And this is, I think, at the same time I saw then again later, unrelated, but when I started Thai boxing, when I started going into from football and like ball sports, I switched to Taekwondo at some point, and then into martial arts. And in Thai boxing. My mom, that was then a social pedagogist in a school, and I would give a homework class there to folks to earn a little pocket money for, you know, while I was studying. I had all these super problematic kids that I saw again in that gym that I was doing Muay Thai myself, and they were in line, you know, because they were being broken down and then being built up at the same time, given structure, something to go by in terms of a role model and a place where they can actually earn some respect and where they want to be seen, you know.
Yeah, that's crazy. And I think it's also crazy that it's so much about a physical component. You always see this, right? That school, maybe that brings us back to this ADHD or whatever, whatchamacallit, thing, where it's like the general school is just not a good predictor of who's going to do well. Like doing well in school is not actually... Like somebody with an entrepreneurial spirit shouldn't do well in school. It like not the way school is now for the most part. But then you go to PE, to physical education, or to some sort of training gym where actually fun, you know, what's school? It's a set of games, but the game's a bit stupid. It's like, sit here, be quiet most of the time, know things when I ask you. And so there's like a really, that's really weird, right? That doesn't seem flowy. Yeah. That doesn't seem... And I don't want to just go into a standard bit on school system bad, because there are things that are good about it because it teaches many kids important things. But, you know, so there's always a balance to be found. And so most thick heads, troublemakers, and people who chat too much in a classroom are actually have great potential. They just need to be put into the right games. And then a good sports teacher, man, right? And this is, you're kind of like describing the ultimate, the intellectual sports teacher, right? Speaks well and then fights well, throws the keys at you and then puts you in the right position, breaks you down, builds you up, but also, you know, has to show for it physically. You know, you can't just, you have a feeling with some of the soft teacher guys and girls that you can run away from them, run them down, whatever, anyway, but not this guy, right? So you actually have to have a little bit of bodily, physical, grounded respect. It seems to me that so many nerdy types and their heady problems can actually be solved with physical activity. I count myself into that as well.
Just a disclaimer, we don't condone throwing keys at children in this podcast.
No, of course not. What Simon says is correct in that the Germany, what's very specific for Germany is that it's a very non-physical culture, and it grew in the way that I can explain it to myself, out of a very anti-authoritarian kind of phase, of course, in the 70s. But at this particular stage, and I personally only have this in Germany, outside of being an immigrant and kind of, you know, looking a little different than other folks, and being shown that, it's also that people are physically intimidated often, you know. And I don't have that in other countries where kind of a kind of masculine or kind of strong, you know, presence is not seen as something negative.
Oh.
Like I had this problem that, you know, in the consulting firm that I was at, and this was my first experiences of actually in an environment that I cared about, somebody, you know, kind of giving me bad feedback, negative feedback in terms of how I look or how I appear was... And the message was actually correct. Was my boss telling me, look, you have to be more aware whom you sit across, because you have a certain effect the way that you are. You have a certain effect that you need to be aware of, and you need to speak. When I speak, maybe it also comes across now, I speak very softly, generally. Mm-hmm. It's because generally people are intimidated by me. I learned that in terms of physically or by the presence in kind of a way. I learned to work with them, but then the first time it was very rough. He said the guy left, our client left, and he pulled my boss aside and he told him, what's with this guy? Is he a football player or is he a bodybuilder? I mean, as if it matters, right? But it was the guy was intimidated by me. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is a theme that I kind of feel it pursues me across not just me, but across my life here. It's something that in the US was much different. If you're buff, people are like, "Yeah, awesome, you're buff." If you come across buff, you're like, "What do? Are you a boxer? Are you aggressive? Are you XYZ?" And it's like, no, it's just part of our life, right? It's part of us being humans and part of us being physical
and
beings,
then,
right?
Then so, what interests me here is, as an introduction, just because obviously you mentioned it, you're an immigrant. Do you also then account this, like for this reaction, only by your physical appearance in terms of like you're well-trained, or do you also think that there's some obvious bias because you just look different?
Yeah. There's a lot of bias. And I will say as a disclaimer and upfront, it's not a German thing. It's a human thing. It's a human thing to be afraid of what you don't know. And it is the only place that but let's say sadly in a way, actually the US made me feel more at home than here, right? Because I mean, nobody gives a fuck where you're from. Everybody can be an American. It's the old story. But I go there and people are like, "You are, where are you from?" And I say, "I'm German." And they look at me and say, "Oh, that's great. Awesome. Welcome." You know what I mean? I don't look like a German, but at the same time, they don't care. You know, it's fine. And of course, when I talk about the US, they talk about San Francisco and California and yada, 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 right? So, but the bottom line is that I do get looks here. It's part of my drive. I learned. It's part of my drive too, is to show people something that, you know, when I was talking about before, is the subconscious drive is always there, not always healthy. I kind of had to learn to turn it into something healthy, is to establish myself in a way, and not in an aggressive way, but just for myself and kind of to be a good example, actually. You know, I generally aspire to be a good memory in people that, you know, interact with me. And I do see myself as an ambassador for immigration and also for Persian people.
That's so wholesome.
I mean, the other option is to be angry, and I chose not to be.
Yes, exactly, and that's what I wanted. Yes, that's what I wanted to point out. I am so impressed by you approaching it this way, because obviously there's a very different approach to this, which is being angry and just shouting it out into the world, and. Yeah. We have this, we don't go super deep into political stuff here, but I think on the podcast in general, but I think in this specific case, when you specifically make the case for how you interact with this, I think it's fair to do that. Yeah. There is a very large, or very strong, movement or opinion of like specifically calling out these things, naming them, but not showing like a reaction, just asking for this to stop. I think that while this is true, of course, I think you specifically, because you are so well educated as well, but also a thoughtful person, introspective person. Yeah. You really, as you mentioned, when you speak like this soft spoken thing, I was thinking about the whole time, like how to put that picture of you, because we actually have never met in person. I mean, I've seen photos of you, but and we only talk over online chat comms. Video call, but we have never met. So to me, you never seemed threatening or anything at all. But obviously, you have that thing that you might be treated differently, and the way you choose to do that, which to me, obviously, in Germany, as somebody who looks pretty German, potato person, I don't know. I don't know how that is, but the way you are very wholesomely like approaching this it shows a greatness to me that I want to aspire to in other like ways of life where I think maybe people pick me up differently, or it's doesn't have to be because of the way I look or whatever, but it can be for whatever reason. So I really want to drive this point and like want to give you a chance to go deeper on this, because I really think that makes you very special.
Thank you very much. And this is the very polished version of me. And what I said before, you know, I can understand, you know, I can understand both sides. It's the problem in this whole thing is that there is a taboo around a topic that in itself is not a taboo. It's immigration in itself is a complicated topic, period. It's just from a human perspective, it's a complicated topic in itself. And the only one that I'm upset with is politics for not addressing it the right way and providing the education necessary for folks to treat it that way, because we're not allowed to talk about it this way, we're not allowed to talk that way, instead of just saying, hey, looks, it's a scary thing for everybody, and let's learn how to deal with it. You know, there is a different way to talk about it, a different way to prepare and deal people with, without blaming, without pushing, because I understand, for myself too, if I was German and I had zero touch points with any kind of immigrants in a way, I would be scared too, because I don't know. You know, I don't know what these guys are like. And then I hear too many things in the media and yada, yada, yada. And it asks for a lot of, you know, reflected time that you spend with the topic to actually build out your opinion in this kind of way, that not when you're not forced to, a lot of people won't do it. And I cannot blame them. But how this conversation is being led by politics is just completely wrong. And this is what's dangerous in this whole thing.
And, and I want to bring something in that I've been thinking about that relates to this, I think. Let's see if it hits home. So I have this thought of these in-between people, the people in the middle, that actually have the chance that come around every 1,000 years. No, there are actually quite many of them. they have, the immigrant is a perfect archetype for that.
Yep.
But I also think the gamer is often a great archetype for that. I definitely feel like one of these in the middle people. For me, you know, I'm just going to try to run this out, so bear with me for a moment. So I was born or conceived from two people who are very different, my mom and my dad, who didn't get along in the end. So they separated, right? So you're already left in the middle as a kid, right? Who do you go to? There's not one unit. And then I've had this feeling of never really feeling at home, you know? I've always said, for some reason, even in the village where I'm at, where I was growing up, at three, I sometimes was like, I don't know anybody here. And then it's like, yeah, but you're three, you know? But my grandparents were actually also immigrants in a way, because they came back in the day from Romania, because they were Transylvanian Saxons, and then they came to Vienna, and then they came to like Heilbronn, and then they came to Hanover Hildesheim. So there isn't a generational consistency, right? And I think that's what I felt, crazily enough, already as a child, as like I should know the people better, or I have a feeling that some people, adults, know each other better than my grandparents or parents know the people here in the village, which was true, because after three generations or something, you were a local, and we were not locals, right? Yeah. So I also am an immigrant of a sort, even though I'm
absolutely.
I grew up very white, very German type.
Yeah.
And then, sure. But something always felt a bit different. And so I have a feeling that this little difference, this little offness, this little, that brings you into a role. And that's kind of my story of the people of the middle, this translator role. And for me, what you're describing right now, you described like two general themes, you know, an immigrant, a different looking dude, you know, being at home in this world, in this industry, whatever. And of course, gaming, again, very welcoming and so on. But you said you notice it, especially in your more traditional job. And the other thing that you mentioned that I picked up is the negotiation between like nerdiness and physicality, which I think is like super interesting. Because many people think they can only present as like a believable nerd if they're kind of scrawny or like not really. But to be a bodybuilder, football player looking guy, and to also be a genuine nerd, that's kind of a bit harder to sell.
Which for example is so much more common in the US.
Totally.
You've got all these super smart guys that are for CrossFitters. You know, you're like, why not both?
And then, of course, the physicality makes the first impression that really hits you because we're biologically wired.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, this guy can't be that. And, I mean, that's almost like the same problem that, as far as I can perceive it, women sometimes have, where they're just perceived as this woman is very good looking. Surely she's not smart, right? Which is a very unfortunate. And I've read so much about this, and there's this, My point is like, it's so important for everybody, for you and for us and for everybody who hears this, is like, if you find yourself in the middle of these things, man, like try to actually translate. And it's harder because you have to build a more layered like persona to the outside as well, but it's worth it because we need it, because we want super intelligent nerds to be physically strong, and we want super hot women to be smart and capable, and there are 100 more of these translator in between areas that I don't even know about because I've never seen them, right? These are just two very lame basic examples.
And in the end of the day, you know, I agree. And in the end of the day, it's that switch, you know, it's for me somewhere there in the 20s, probably with the startup stuff and so on, where I said, okay, I'm actually good at this. The time before that was two phases of like in both ways, both professionally, which I didn't have a career yet, but I also didn't have a path yet. Because I didn't know where I belong, what I was good at. And then on the personal way as well, where I always feel like a certain disconnectedness and, you know, where I was not, I was always one between a lot of different groups. I'm hyper compatible now in this particular, there's nobody that you can sit me next to that I cannot speak with and that I cannot have a good conversation.
Yeah, that's also a factor, right? That happens. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. And it comes out of this, you know, where do I belong? There's a little bit of me in here. There's a little bit of me in there, but nothing complete. And then in the end of the day, finding the confidence to say, okay, this is me and I'll just do it my way now. And I have a few of my role models, but this is my way. And this is the way that I think I want to be as a person. This is how I want to be to other people. This is exactly, even though I don't see anybody, don't want to see anybody, but Florian, as you pointed out, you know, the way that I am is perhaps not so common. You know, I mean, where do I get this from? It's at some point I had to make up my own mind what I think is right or wrong in terms of how to act, how to deal with the problem, and how to do it myself. And this is the same way that I now run a company where I'm saying like, okay, I have to find my own flavor in this. And this is, I think this is the number one advice to anybody is find your own flavor in terms of how you do things, whatever it is. Be it personal life, be it professional life, whatever it is, find your own flavor and you will find the people alongside that go with you. It's maybe 1 out of 1,000, but that one person is really worth it, you know?
One thing that you just said as a, and that I want to put that on a pedestal, that you said in your explanation of how other people react and how you deal with it is, you just mentioned in like a half sentence, and I don't blame them for that, which is like one of the most important things in this whole story, I think, because at the moment it is very, very common to start with blaming people and then wanting them to change. And to me, this is a very, very wrong approach, and it has led to a culture of not being able to talk to each other, being able... It might hurt. We can even go into religion, which I am not a religious person, but we can go into Christianity, which is the prevalent thing, is like turn the other cheek. I feel like of course you don't have to be religious, but like be the better person. Even that should be something to aspire to, and to say, First of all, I don't blame you, but we should talk about this because I don't agree with you.
Yeah, it's very, very good perception. This is my attitude. It comes from religion, and it's not that I'm a religious guy, but it's again how I grow. It's that theme goes across my whole life. It's like a muesli pack. it's like a box of cereal with so much different things in it that I just picked from. But my mom, I mean, we're not religious. We fled from that institutionalized, you know, Islam that was instilled that had nothing to do with actual Islam, and so. We fled here, and my mom, as a very open-minded person at some point, gave me a book about Buddhism. Uh-huh. And I read it, and it says very clearly, if somebody does something wrong, it's because they don't know better. And you can try to this. It's a very substantial, fundamental mm-hmm. way that you look at things.
Yes.
Right? It's if I free somebody from bad intention, then it takes away my judging, right? And so this at the very core is my belief. Mm-hmm. I believe if somebody, and this includes myself, if I make mistakes, it's because I don't know better. Of course, there are people that might be in intent, but it's not everybody. I think the majority of people do not know better, and I can try my part to help them understand. And if they can't, then I just leave it as that. But it's not personal. It has more to do with them than with me, and it doesn't come from a bad place. You know, and this in itself, I chose. Yes. Because I didn't want to carry around anger. Mm-hmm.
So this is very inspirational at the moment. I want to move to something else, which
sure.
I think in the end, if I am right with my perception, we will still come to something very inspirational. But we built you up as this nice person and this great guy now. So, but now we need to tear you down a little bit. And, I want to talk about something, and it's a setup. It's a red herring. He's still a great guy. Let's talk a little bit about it because we have the story now that says, well, this is how I dealt with everything. And then obviously, like, something didn't go well for me, but then like I decided to change something in my life, or I decided to change how I approach things. But in there somewhere must be like things that didn't work out. And like, you know, when you are somebody who's really entrepreneurial, of course, you start thinking about businesses and everything. You start about earning money. You start about hiring people and so on. So at some point there must have been something that didn't work out. Do you have an example of that?
My whole life is a series of failures. Very clearly, I that's why I always start my conversation. This and it's the most important things. If you look at my CV, it looks like there was any kind of idea or system behind it, because I did startup, then I did strategy, then I did corporate, then I did finance, and all of a sudden you have actually a very well-rounded entrepreneurial person. Mm-hmm. But in between those elements, I didn't know what I was going to do. So my first startup, very frankly, I got kicked mm-hmm. out of, because I was too inexperienced, and it was a super hard lesson in which I, in a way where I was this smart ass kid that, you know, was always good at stuff and so on. First dip I take into the professional world, I see these guys hustle differently and just talking sweet won't get me anywhere. That was my first check. So that was the first check. Then I go into consulting. In between, I was like, I have this problem that, you know, I don't want to get a regular sales job. I don't know what I was good at. Otherwise, I'm a good talker. You know, I'm a good salesperson. I believe in what I do, yada, yada, yada. But I also don't want to I don't want to do sales. Nothing bad about sales, but I felt like my interests were just more varied. Mm-hmm. In particular, after you had there was like a holistic experience as a founder. So I wanted to continue on that path. And found through again a contact, got kind of an introduction to that consulting firm. At the consulting firm, I saw that, you know, in various checks of these, that, you know, just by my physical presence, it seems like, you know, people are offended, and I kind of have to learn a lot, kind of had me, threw me back in so many ways that I had to be very... You have to, where I question myself a lot, you know, how should I be, what do I want to be, and so on and so forth. Then went to Google. Google went pretty well up until kind of like the very end. At the end of those 6 years of my 3 years experience in the US, of course, you know, in the end, I kind of banged heads, unfortunately, with my boss, where again, I saw that, you know, that there is there is no safe place, so to say, in work, which is, you know, kind of also a place like Google. At some point, if push comes to shove, it's the manager's or the director's world and not yours. So there was my life was, I had a lot of these experiences for sure. Anything more specific that you would like to know?
No, I think it drowns out the picture a little bit, because I'm interested in, well, now I'm interested in something else that you mentioned at the end, but I'm interested in how people deal with failure in general. And because when I was running, I mean, I also curate talks for MediaNet sometimes now, panels and such, if they fit for our events. But I used to run a conference, and usually people come to conferences, professional conferences, and want to sell themselves, sell a company, sell a product, go on stage, talk about how amazing everything is. And I really enjoy talking to people on a different level, and also talking to, like, listening to people who are not afraid of going on a stage and just, like, going through all their failures. And I think that if you look at my CV, your CV, whoever's CV, it's a polished version of us. And of course, we can go into social media and all that other stuff. So every aspect of this, and then also the career, it has to be, like, very streamlined. But I stopped caring about that quite a while ago. And so I always, if I have the feeling that a person or like inspires me in the way they are, I want to hear more from them about how they perceive their lives in terms of failure and how they dealt with it. Because usually you can dig up a lot about like that. And that just usually gets you beautiful stories.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if I look at, the way I like to think about myself is that probably one of my top soft skills is resilience. In the end of the day, it's a attribute that's not spoken about enough. But you learn at some point that you cannot prepare for every situation, but you can prepare for what the situation does with you. And the further you go, the more these situations will occur. I learned also that no matter what I do, if I keep putting in the work, I will get to where I want. Maybe not exactly where I plan to go, but I will get somewhere, right? If I just keep putting in the work. And I think this is where a lot of people kind of, when they see the stories, when they see whatever story they seem to look at as a success story, that those failures and somebody to just keep pushing, keep going through these cycles of frustration and mishaps and so on and so forth, for you to just keep going is I think the most important thing in life. It's the number one. It's because things will always go wrong. The higher you go up the ladder, the weirder the stuff gets. Like I realize it as my, it's just at some point there's no normal topics anymore. You know, it's like we're leading a company of 50 people, only 50 people, you know, and I have topics on my table on a day to day where, you know, it's just heavy topics that need heavy decisions and, you know, million euro contracts and stuff that I wasn't used to a few months ago. And you grow accustomed to that, but I can only imagine what that looks like to a guy like Mark Zuckerberg, right? Mark Zuckerberg is like, I mean, the topics that he has on his table is nothing normal anymore about that, probably. Right? It's just like, what do we do with China? What do we do with Russia? What do we do with the league? And then you speak in front of Congress, and then we have to let go. I mean, look at it from that perspective. What does it do to you as a person? Yes. I personally had two cycles of therapy sessions that I did voluntary out of my own. And it's without that, I would not be where I am at now, because to disconnect from all the failures and mishaps and the pressures and the thoughts about what if this goes wrong? It's crippling.
Yeah, and I really feel for Zuckerberg, for example, because you have also the extraterrestrials, the lizard people, like all these people. You have to like
run the. I was like going okay.
Yeah, like you know, the robots, the AI. Yeah. You know,
yes.
If you're the Lord of robots, you really have to, you know, make some important decisions. So Zuck probably, you know, also needs a very good therapist.
poor Bill Gates. Right, sorry, but the poor Bill Gates. Yeah. You know, we always say, why is there no rich person that does something for the world? Now comes the first guy, they say, oh, he tries to rule the world. yo, we just asked for that. You know, it's like, put your money there. And all of a sudden, he's a conspirator.
That's pretty funny.
What's going on here?
Let's not sway too deep into the into that. Like, one last final short topic I want to make up or come to from this point that we just had is we often ask people why they... We often have people on who have interesting stories, of course. Otherwise, it would be a boring podcast. And then we have people on who found their own companies or work in a higher position in companies, because usually that also entails you have to have a bigger understanding of like how a company functions, how the industry functions, because you need to be aware of what's going on around. So it's just in general more interesting people to talk to. But like the way you mentioned it, like, I felt you had a few points in your life, in your career, when you like butted heads with your boss. And I think if I remember correctly, like, we never had as a motivational factor from our guests the need to found or to lead, because you would like always get into fights with the people who would be the ones making the final decision. And that's something that I'm also very interested now, because I feel once you make that step over that certain line where you all of a sudden are responsible making decisions on behalf of other people that impact other people, your viewpoint changes completely or a lot. And then you also understand, like you said, we made fun of it, but Zuckerberg is an extreme example. But you usually start to understand more like why your boss makes a decision like that. And I think it's a very interesting process of how you become like from an employee to that point where you disagree. And then maybe you get frustrated and then you don't like bring your full potential to work, or you decide to change something, or you decide to leave and do your own thing.
Yeah.
So
yes, absolutely.
So
100%.
You then chose to do your own thing.
Yeah. So it's you know, in that whole started again all the way back in school, you know, but as being an opinionated person, yada yada yada, you get to the point where you have to show. Mm-hmm. I was so opinionated in so many ways, and I already had that experience as a founder. So that even when I started in my jobs, I feel like I had a little bit of a wider horizon where people got so, you know, obsessed with, oh, why is this not happening for my function unit? I'm like, okay, but there's other areas, other units, more complex and strategy. Yeah. Even with understanding part of that, there's two elements. One of them is the immediate leadership that you're under, where you're like, I don't agree with how you do things. Mm-hmm. And the other one is the unhappiness with being in a big company. And I always say Google is a great company. It's probably one of the best big companies that there is, but it's a big company. And that in itself, I mean, I was doing business development in Germany. Half of the projects that were rolled out were rolled back. And it was an incredibly frustrating experience that is very big company stuff. And so I realized I can't do that forever. It just makes me deeply unhappy to stay in that. Either you shift your focus completely and don't care about work much. And then, you know, I still say perhaps I return to Google at some point because, you know, I think being there, having kids and all that kind of stuff, beautiful and amazing experience probably. But being that hungry, kind of driven guy that I was, it was
where you actually want to get stuff across the line, then, right?
Oh man, I want to move stuff. You know, I really want to make stuff better, and it pains me to see opportunities and not realize them. It's a drive, and so. And then the other piece is in fact leadership, where you get into these moments and you're like, you know, I think it should be done differently. And the manager with whatever they see, or the leadership that with whatever they do, they handle things a certain way. And that can go all the way from doing strategic decisions. Do we do a certain deal? Don't we do a deal? Do we staff up? How do we staff this team? All the way to, you know, how do we escalate internally? How do we, you know, whom do we back? Whom do we support? And yada, yada, yada. There's so many different facets to it that I thought, and I just got to this point where I said, okay, if, you know, I like from, you know, Google and my manager not approving of certain deals or the way that we should do it. That's, for example, it's like a little internal. So Amazon Kindle was, of course, very established in terms of books. I was sitting with a strategic partnership team in Hamburg at Google, and part of those guys were working on Google Books, which is like the Google version of Kindle that wasn't launched yet. And these guys, that poor bastards, with a product that hasn't been launched in the market versus Amazon Kindle, were asked to go out and ask for more aggressive terms with the publishers than Amazon. And I think to myself, that's not the way to drive a product into the market. If I'm Google and I want to drive this, I have cash. Cash is not my problem. They have so much cash that their balance sheet looks like a bank.
Yep.
So they need to move that money somewhere. Just push it into the market aggressively. I don't care. Just give it away for free. Whatever you do, why? You know, the answer I can tell you why is there's a product manager sitting somewhere in Mountain View, and he's thinking, oh, yeah, everybody should because we're Google and so on. And this is not how you play. This is not how you play to win. And I decided for myself, okay, I want to see, you know, do I know better in terms of, you know, how do we play to win? And the other one is, am I really right in terms of the decisions that I think we should have been making along the kind of way? And as you kind of grow, so for me at some point, the answer was clear. I have to go and do my own thing. Actually, Malte drove me into making that step to C-level faster than I thought I was ready, but it turns out I was actually ready. And or at least so I want to believe. I do feel comfortable
you're doing
in this
it.
Role
Let's
after,
say.
You know. Exactly. So, but you know, from I got kicked out of my own startup, you know, 13, 15 years earlier, you're always with that anxiety running around. Am I ready to go back? That was the only thing that kept me back. You know, am I ready for the driver's seat again? And it seems that I was, you know, and so, you know, these things go along. And then of course you realize, man, some of these situations are tough. Let's say, I banged heads with that last manager of mine that was the number two at Waze. So Waze is the navigation that Google acquired, Israeli startup that acquired it. And I adored and I do still adore the CEO, Noam Bardeen, which is one of the most brilliant and nicest, kindest people that I had the pleasure to work with, that also turned to a very big role model of mine in terms of how I want to be and so on and so forth. And as this kind of relationship came to an end, also my relationship to him kind of unfortunately cooled down a lot. And before he was this guy in an office of 20, because most of Waze was sitting in Israel, he was sitting with us just across from the table for 3 years. So that relationship cooled down and I was very upset about it. And I didn't understand. And now I understand better how a complicated character like me, also in a constellation like that, is difficult for him to handle because it gets very political, you know? So your perspectives change as you kind of move along. Some things you realize you might be right about. Other things you realize are just more complex than they are. And some just, you know, some just have, some issues don't have satisfactory solutions. That is, I think, part of business as well.
Yeah.
Thank you for your stories. Very nice. Thanks for the deep look. Yeah. We'll move to a little segment of ours, which are essential questions. A little more or less quick fire round to wrap it up. Sometimes they give a little reprise of what we already talked about. Sometimes they bring up something new. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. Let us begin. First question, what inspires you?
So I would say two things. One is turnaround characters. Like I love an underdog story. I love a Mike Tyson story, coming from nowhere, getting to somewhere, and then just in between realizing it's a super complicated and complex character. And the other one is just artistic expression of any kind, be that music, be that art, be that culinary, be that games, design. Whatever it is where I sit, and I'm like, how does this get out of somebody's head into reality? It's just absolutely mind-blowing.
Hell yeah. What is the purpose of your being?
That's a very good question. I feel like I want to believe I want to believe I'm here to connect and unite people. I think it's a little bit of my role is to be the connector, the uniter, and maybe the guy that fights a few fights for others.
Speaking of the translators, very nice. Yes. What's a beautiful day to you?
A beautiful day usually involves my friends, good food, good music, potentially just some sunshine and some nature, and that's it. That's my when I look back at the days that I enjoy most, and probably it's usually a constellation of that.
What is the change you want to see in the world?
I think you know the. I think within those times is what you guys mentioned too, for everybody to start looking more at themselves rather than others, you know, being less judgmental and looking for ways to be more open-minded themselves.
And how do you contribute to that?
Hopefully by being a role model.
Nice. If you would start a new safe game in your life now, what occupation would your new character have?
I would probably be, I might want to be a top chef, like a cook, like a top chef.
Nice.
Like something then.
Do you cook actually?
Somewhere in me. Yeah. I cook. Yeah. I love food in many ways. And it's, for me, it's an expression of art as well. And it's the same character. I love Chef's Table, the series on Netflix. Absolutely. Super my thing. And also a lot of underdog stories, if you look at that, where people just didn't get at all what they were doing. And now they're superstars.
Yeah. Love food as well. Would visit your restaurant if you were indeed a top chef.
Yeah.
Last question from me. Do you have books that you would want to recommend or that you often recommend to other people?
So books. One is actually really because I have to push myself not to only read Sachbücher.
Nonfiction.
Nonfiction, yes. Is Siddhartha, Hermann Hesse. I love that whole story. I think it's written so incredibly beautifully. I read it every year once again, and it teaches me something else. It's absolutely outstanding. I still try to wrap my head around how this guy knew so much about that religion so early on. I mean, before Wikipedia.
I can then actually tell you, because I'm a big Hesse fan, and I've researched it a bit, but that's probably for another time. But
you have to. Yeah, let's talk after the show about this. I'm super.
Yeah, I'll tell you a little bit.
So. Then I would say I love Thinking Fast and Slow because it talks a lot about Daniel Kahneman. Kahneman, yeah. It's a lot about first impressions, right? How our brain works. This is the entry point into how things just trigger stuff in you as you see them. And then probably... what was the last one? A New Earth.
Eckhart Tolle.
Or Eckhart Tolle, yeah. Eckhart Tolle is my guy.
Yeah, my guy too.
For mindfulness, yeah, totally. Learn a lot.
Yeah, it's great.
Spooky how he speaks out of my mind, yeah, totally.
Yeah, he's a fun dude too. Ah, cool, cool list, yeah. Enjoy that.
Sweet.
Yeah.
I
have to comment. Sorry, A New Earth is like the book two of the first one was Power of Now, and I'm now that's Simon right, everywhere on the internet, and that's definitely from the Power of Now. And A New Earth is like the same, but almost like a little bit better, a little bit more refined, a little bit smoother.
Yes.
So yeah, it's a great one. Yeah,
totally.
Okay, that's something to geek out about. That's nice.
Yeah.
So we stick with lists. What are your favorite games?
Yeah, favorite games. I would go with God of War, Ghost of Tsushima, number one. It's interesting how I don't have a hard time saying that, even though there's so many other good titles. Ghost of Tsushima just hit it out of the park for me so hard because I'm a big Japanophile and all that kind of stuff. The way it was done is just art. And then the third one is a little tougher to decide, but probably Horizon in the way that it caught me back in the day. So it's all the same theme. But,
all right.
Yeah.
Who is somebody from the games industry or esports in general? When I say games industry, I usually mean it as an all-encompassing thing. Who you would like to get to know?
I would like to meet the Riot founders at some point. I think what they did was very exceptional in the way kind of they set the tone for the esports industry. I think that would be it.
Interesting. Nice. What our guests only hear after we ask the question and they give the answer is that we have a hidden trapdoor, which means that once you tell us, we will try to make it happen. Can't promise results very fast, but it is now on my to-do list or on our to-do list to connect you in some way. You never know when it happens.
Awesome.
Who is someone you know who you think we should have on the podcast?
I think Jens Hilgers. Jens Hilgers is somebody that you should speak to in terms of esports and also kind of his whole path. Yeah. Is super interesting. It's far from the standard story and went on to build great things. So super interesting character. Also learned a lot from him. And another one actually that I wanted to place because I kind of thought about that was Ralf Wenzel, a good friend of mine, former MD SoftBank and so on and so forth. Has a very interesting background in between orphanage and kind of having grown up partly in Cuba and in Germany and just being this absolutely incredible person, entrepreneur, so super interesting character.
Is he in gaming?
No, not
okay,
in gaming.
That's going to be difficult for this format, but thanks to CEO at Joker. Do I see that
right? We will see where this goes. It's a long format podcast, so maybe there's also a long format life for the whole thing. So at the end of the games industry when we have reached it.
when we reach the credits of the games.
When you finished
exactly,
it.
Yes.
Durchgespielt.
Finally durchgespielt, Alter. Okay.
And the last question, where can people find you?
LinkedIn, Amir Mirzai, Base Esports, LinkedIn profile as well. Do get in touch with us. Anything you guys wanna learn. We're sitting here in Kreuzberg, Berlin. Super nice area as well. Anything you guys would like to learn or get in touch with, I'd be open to chat.
Cool. Amir, thanks for being on the podcast. It was a blast talking to you. Simon, thanks for co-hosting as always.
My last words are after talking to you, Base Esports, more like Based Esports. So thank you for this very grounding and based conversation, bro.
I appreciate it, guys. Thank you so much. It's such a cool format. Thank you for having me and then spending the time here. Very nice. I appreciate it.
All right. See you soon and goodbye.
Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Hi there. Simon here. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you like what you hear here and you would like to hear more here, feel free to follow or to subscribe to the podcast on whichever platform you get your audio fix. We appreciate you and we promise you to bring you many more insightful conversations with fantastic games industry guests from Berlin and from all over Europe. Thank you very much and see you very soon. Bye bye.
Hi there. Before you go, this is Florian, project manager for GamesNet Berlin Europe. If you want to stay connected to the network, find out more about upcoming events and links to other MediaNet initiatives, you can visit us at gamesnetberlin.eu and subscribe to our newsletter. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast and until next time.